from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll find out about a galaxy far, far away that's coming to our state museum.
I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Garden Club's 18th Annual Garden Walk.
And I'll chat with some of the people behind We Are City. Plus, there'll be our arts counter we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. From a galaxy far, far away comes an exhibit unlike any other to the Indiana State Museum, Star Wars. Travis DiNicola spoke with Tracy Cromwell, Director of Collections, to find out more.
Tracy, welcome to Art of the Matter. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. So this is pretty exciting. I mean, this is just an extremely cool exhibit I've been hearing about for a while. I know you guys have been excited about it coming here. Before we get into everything that is so cool about the Star Wars exhibit, though, just help me understand a little bit, not that I'm complaining, but what does a Star Wars exhibit have to do with the Indiana State Museum?
Well, this particular Star Wars exhibit deals with the science, engineering, and robotics that are used in all six Star Wars movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. A lot of that robotics and engineering and science technology is being used and researched at many universities here in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we are working with Rose Holman in particular in the robotics department to do a lot of lectures and programs during the run of the Star Wars exhibit.
Very cool. Okay. And really, I mean, the State Museum is an educational organization.
Yes.
And the exhibits that you guys have are not necessarily all limited to just, you know, a narrow interpretation of Indiana history or culture.
No, part of our mission is bringing the culture and science and technology of the world to Indiana as well. So we don't want to just talk about Indiana history and stay stuck on that. We want to bring the world to Indiana.
And or bring a galaxy from far, far away to Indiana, I suppose.
Yes, in this case.
Okay, so let's talk about the exhibit, because this is just really fun. How was this exhibit put together? I mean, this was all done by Lucasfilms and museum curators, or you know, is it like a package deal, or do you guys get some say in the involvement of this, or how does that all work?
Actually, it's a traveling exhibit that was put together by the Museum of Science Boston several years ago.
Okay.
All of the artifacts and technology in the exhibit are borrowed from Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm.
So they put together this exhibit with the help of Lucasfilm, and it has been traveling the world for 6 years now.
Okay.
And we're one of the last two venues to get it.
And do you get like some opportunity to, within the exhibit itself, I mean, you're talking about the work, you know, certainly with the universities, but within the exhibit itself, do you have, you know, some opportunity to sort of personalize it for Indiana? A little, not much.
Not much, yeah. Really, at all. We're going to do that through a lot of our programming.
I see.
Like
okay.
I said, with Rose Holman lectures and any summer camps that we're doing for kids. Really, through the programming, we're going to drive that Indiana component.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense. So the exhibit includes, among other really cool artifacts and things, the opportunity to actually sit inside the Millennium Falcon. Is that right?
Yes. It's called the Millennium Falcon Experience. It is a separate component of the exhibit that will be in our main lobby of the museum.
Okay.
It's rather huge. It's a dome theater component. Mm-hmm. So you are experiencing riding in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon.
So it's the cockpit, not the whole Millennium Falcon.
Not the whole Millennium Falcon. But it's still rather large, mm-hmm. and four people get to sit in the pilot and the co-pilot chairs, and you watch through the window of the Millennium Falcon a sort of journey through the galaxy narrated by C-3PO.
That's so fun.
It is fun.
Oh, cool. And then there's also another component where there's so Luke Skywalker's land speeder. Is that right?
Yes, it's his actual land speeder as part of the exhibit, as well as the actual little miniature model of the Landspeeder with Ken dolls inside, dressed up as Luke Skywalker. And then also an interactive next to that Landspeeder where people can experience how it felt to ride in the Landspeeder.
That's got to be so cool.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Now, you've seen this exhibit on at other museums? Is that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I went in the fall to see it at the Orlando Science Center, who currently has it right now, and it closes in a week and a half, I believe.
Okay. So, and then coming straight from there to here.
And then it travels here, and we will have it installed and ready by May. May 25th, the exhibit opens, and we do get the Millennium Falcon experience up and running a little bit before then.
Very fun. Now, are you a Star Wars fan yourself?
I remember going to see the first movie when I was a small child, but I wasn't a huge fan. My husband is a huge, huge Star Wars fan, so I know about it through him.
You've become a fan.
I've become a huge fan because you have to learn so much when you get an exhibit like this. There's so much terminology and all of these different aspects of the movies you need to learn, and the characters and lines that people say, and it's a lot to learn, and I really do enjoy it now.
So, I mean, the science part of this, and I don't mean to sound skeptical, but, you know, since the world of Star Wars is in a galaxy far, far away, and you know, there's questions about, you know, are the rules of physics even the same in the world of Star Wars? I mean, how does that science transfer in a way that people will get something out of this exhibit other than that, oh, that's just a really cool model factor?
Well, one cool section of the exhibit is talking about the medical aspects used in the movies. And so you can sort of see how robots are used to do surgeries, like when Luke's hand is cut off by Darth Vader.
Right, okay.
And he gets a replacement robotic hand. And it's all done with robots doing the surgery. And surgeries do happen today where a doctor doesn't actually touch you. Robots do all of the work. It's great cutting-edge technology that happens even here in this state.
Have you found that I mean, George Lucas, in his work in creating these films, was relying on, you know, actual technology and science maybe just accelerated a bit?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it seems like he did enough research and has this vast knowledge of so many different aspects that are then rolled into the movies, from science and technology to art and costume design and all of these aspects, that he had a hand in making these movies happen. It's just incredible.
So what's your favorite part of the exhibit? Can you pick anything specific? Or?
I like the Wampa.
The Wampa? Tell me about that.
The Wampa is sort of the abominable snowman that lives on the planet Hoth.
Yeah, okay.
And he is trying to eat Luke as a snack before Han Solo barges in and saves him from the Wampa. But I really like the Wampa.
You know, I totally forgot that was the name of that creature. I mean, and you say you're not a fan. You're a fan. You know the Wampa.
I've always liked him, but now I know more about him.
Now you know more about the Wampa. So how's that work? Is there like a small miniature model of the Wampa? Is there a big Wampa?
A lot of the exhibit is the actual costumes and props used in the movie. So there is the actual Wampa costume that someone wore in the movie, as well as Chewbacca and other Wookiees and Han Solo and Darth Vader and Yoda puppet and Padme's costume and different things from all six of the movies.
You know, a big part of putting on museum exhibits, of course, is creating models. And I would have to think that, I mean, a lot of the curators and staff at the State Museum just got to be so excited about seeing some of these models because of the intricacy of the details.
Yeah, I've learned how many employees at the State Museum are true closet Star Wars fans. I have never had so many people offer to help me with my work before.
Well, that's great. What a bonus.
Yeah, it is. But I think everybody is so excited about this exhibit at the museum. From every component we're doing, we're doing an additional Star Wars gift shop, the programming that I've told you about, just the exhibit itself, we have so many people at work that are excited and want to get the word out to as many people as possible to come see this.
That's really cool. That's a lot of fun. Hey, tell me a little bit more about the programming. So, I mean, you know, especially, I mean, some of the stuff that you're going to be doing with younger kids to you know, sort of share that love of science, technology, engineering, and math with those kids.
Well, we are doing a summer camp. Mm-hmm. It's a sci-fi camp. And it will be a lot of science, technology, a lot of hands-on things for the kids to do, as well as them getting to go through the Star Wars exhibit itself several times and to ride the Millennium Falcon as well. And then we're going to do once a month program days in June and July, mm-hmm. that kids can come down and do Jedi training and, you know, really experience hands-on things that they can do, crafts or face painting, and sort of do science-related projects as well during those program days. And I think the one in June is the 20th and July is the 22nd.
I got to say, have you thought about having a summer camp for adults?
We're doing other things for adults.
Okay.
We're doing the weekend of Gen Con.
Mm-hmm. Oh, perfect. Right. And that's in August, of course.
Right. Mm-hmm. In August, we are doing an adult sort of program day that weekend on Saturday night.
Wow, I bet you guys will be overwhelmed for that.
We're hoping it's a huge party. We want people to come dressed up in their costumes, mm-hmm. whether they're at Gen Con or not at Gen Con, to just come down and experience the Star Wars exhibit and have fun at the party.
Now, this is one of the largest exhibits that's ever come to the State Museum, right?
Yeah, pretty much the closest to this size has been Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And it's pretty equivalent in size. This is maybe a little bit bigger.
Yeah. Well, this is very exciting. Anything you would like to add that we maybe did not get a chance to talk about yet?
We are going to be in the 500 Festival Parade as well,
okay.
which is quite exciting.
Yeah.
We are working with the 501st Legion here in Indiana, and that is a group that does total volunteering and helping out to raise funds for children's groups, but they do it dressed in their Star Wars costumes.
Oh, nice.
So they are going to represent the exhibit and the museum in the 500 Festival Parade for us. So there'll be a large group of Star Wars characters in the 500 Parade.
That's a first. That'll be very fun.
And Darth Vader and Chewbacca will be there as well.
Nice. Now, has anyone asked you to put on a costume yet?
Oh, yes, all the time. I get asked at work to show up in my Princess Leia buns to meetings and things like that, but I'm not going to do it.
Well, and it's funny because, I mean, here you showed up, you know, to the radio station dressed as Chewbacca, but, you know, no one can see it. So
I'm not going to do the Wookiee call for you. Sorry.
Travis DiNicola with the Indiana State Museum's Director of Collections, Tracy Cromwell. The Star Wars exhibit opens on May 25th. To buy tickets, call the museum at 317-232-1637, again, 232-1637, or visit online at indianamuseum.org, indianamuseum.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Since 1930, the Indianapolis Garden Club has raised money to improve gardens and green space around the city. Their 18th annual Garden Walk fundraising event is coming up on Wednesday, June 5th, and our own green girl, Sharon Gamble, invited Garden Walk co-chairs Megan Roadhamel and Polly Jameson to our studios to learn more.
So how did you get roped into, how did you volunteer to become co-chairs?
Polly, you should go first.
Yeah, Polly, you're a repeat offender here.
You've gotten to do this twice.
Well, we do try to have a succession where every year we have one person that has been the co-chair and bring on a new one. And so we don't always start out with two people that haven't done the job
before. Sure, with a blank slate.
Right. Yeah. But it did happen last year on my first year.
Uh-oh.
And this things do happen like that.
Sure.
And so we had three rookies last year.
Woohoo!
And I was one of them. And guess what? I was the only one that is back.
She was the only one who was willing to do it again.
Well, congratulations. Good
right.
for you.
And then I recruited Megan.
Yes. Well, and we're all laughing because, you know, it is a labor of love, but it's never as easy to put on any kind of an event as it looks to the public that comes to consume the event. They don't think about all the all the hurdles that have to be cleared on the way.
There's a lot of backstory work to do and a lot of legwork. We started right after last year's garden walk, literally the following week. We
Wow.
were out looking around Indianapolis for the gardens for the walk that's coming up on June 5th.
Well, and the timing of that is really important because you can't really put off your scouting until December because there's nothing to see,
you
much
won't know,
to see then.
Yeah. Exactly. You
yeah.
won't know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
So you need to look when the gardens look good.
Sure.
And last year that was challenging with all the drought that we had.
No more drought. We had three summers in a row. Yeah. We're not going to have that spell of 105 degree days this year, right?
Good.
I mean, I'm just putting
no,
it
we're
out
not.
There for the universe to as much control as we have over it. But tell me about the selection process for the gardens. First of all, you have to have people who are willing to have people come in and tour their garden. But then what are you looking for beyond that?
Well, you did mention we have to have people that are willing. And we have been lucky enough to have owners ask us, could we be on? So that did happen to us this year.
Wow.
That's really nice.
Yes, it is.
And then we work with leads from prior years. Sometimes owners say, I'm not quite ready mm-hmm. this year, but I might be next year or 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we benefited from one of those prospects this year. We have leads from other garden club members or friends of garden club members. And then there's just a lot of driving around.
We drove up and down streets and crisscrossed neighborhoods and looked and thought and who knows who and how can we find who owns this property or that property. And we look for places where it's easy for a lot of people to park, because we don't want anybody to get hurt going to the garden walk. So we don't look at houses on Meridian Street, for instance. We look
Sure.
for neighborhoods where there'll be a lot of parking available. In some previous years, we've had bus service. We're not having to do that this year, which is kind of nice. It's going to save us a little money so that we can give more money away.
Because that's the whole point of this.
This
is to raise
our
money.
Our primary yeah. fundraiser. The Indianapolis Garden Club has been doing this now. This will be our 18th, and we have given away quite a lot of money to the city, all to horticulturally important projects around town, and so we don't want to spend money on buses. We want to give money back to the city.
Sure, so. Exactly. And in looking for places that meet the parameters you've talked about already, do you also then try to balance? So there are five gardens. Are they different kinds of gardens? So are you looking for somebody who's mad about perennials, someone else who has a lot of evergreens, or how do you find that balance? And are you looking for a variety within the five?
We love to have variety, yes. And I think this year we certainly have variety. Although Polly and I were talking earlier, one thing that everybody but one has in common is that these homes were all built in the 20s or 30s,
ah.
which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
One home is more current than that, more recent than that, probably 50s, I would imagine. So that's a nice similarity. But as far as the gardens themselves are concerned, they're all very different. Some more formal than others. One garden in particular, the people love to put artifacts from their travels around the world into their garden. They
Such
specifically
as?
Things
sculpture.
Made of things made of metal and stone and sculpture. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in that particular garden. And
so a lot of stories, too.
A lot of stories, exactly.
Megan referred to that one as the triptych of their
yeah.
travels, because the garden just exemplifies their personalities and who they are, where they've been, and the love of gardening. Great color. You asked some of the parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Design, color,
mm-hmm.
unique perennials and mm-hmm. plants, maybe something our patrons haven't seen before. We try, and I think we've done a good job with that this year.
I think so, yeah.
Something else unique. if you wanted to know, we mentioned the age of the homes.
Yeah.
And with that, naturally, we have some of the best specimens of very old trees this year.
Of course.
That I think everyone would be interested in seeing. And, you know, they've survived many droughts.
Sure.
I don't know if we called last year's a century.
Oh,
at least it
yeah.
was a historic drought.
Yeah, it certainly was.
But these trees are just incredible. And most of them are oaks, some beech, but they're beautiful. And we just, every year is different. The gardens are different every year. But the properties attract a lot of people want to just see the property. We have a range of people that are true gardeners and other people that are there to see the homes and the area.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we always try to balance. And all of the homes are not large and spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
We want to provide our true gardeners with true interest and gardens that the owners are working them in themselves.
Right, as opposed to just hiring out a firm and
yes.
hiring out all the maintenance. Is there are any of these homes that were built in the 20s, or for that matter, the one built in the 50s, do they have gardens that have tried to replicate what might have been historically there?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
For one thing, it's difficult without photographs to ever know exactly what's going on. And one home in particular, the home is quite spectacular. It's our deco drama home. The landscaping has been changed many, many times at this home. And what the current owner is doing is going to be absolutely perfect for this deco home, but it's probably nothing like what was done when the home was originally built, because tastes have changed. People don't necessarily go for the same things that they did 70, 80 years ago in terms of even foundation plantings.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our homeowners has done a lot of investigating to figure out exactly what their property was like.
Aww.
And I don't want to give away, I can't give away the secret because that would spoil everything. But that particular home, the woman literally put her shovel in the dirt to start on her gardens and found something she wasn't expecting. And it has colored the directions
the rest
of her that
journey.
She's gone
sure.
with that garden ever since, which we think is really special. And
ooh.
I'm not going to say any more because
ooh.
You have to have to go to the garden walk to find out any more than that.
I love
about that.
That
one.
I love that. Polly, I'm going to direct this to you because you're the alum in the room. What are some of the behind the scenes challenges that people might not expect? You know, what did you find last year? Was there anything when in the middle of the tour day where you said, oh, shoot, we didn't realize that was going to happen?
Well, we won't talk about the weather.
This, well, yeah. Okay.
This event is always rain or shine. So and our regular walkers, as we call them, know to dress appropriately and wear their rain gear and rain shoes or mud boots.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't a dressy affair. And if you do go to the luncheon at Woodstock, I'm sure no one cares.
You're
going to
be in light company.
Yes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So challenges could be after you get over that, if the ground is wet, which we've had. We did have a flood in 2008,
oof.
Actually, one year, and it worked out just fine. Two of our members just stepped up and opened up their homes, and nobody cared.
Oh,
everybody
wow.
was just thrilled. So it is nice to have a backup plan. I don't.
Sure.
I'm not worried about the elevation this year at any of our five locations. No matter what happens with the rain, I think we'll be fine. Sometimes traffic is, you know, if we haven't thought it out and there was a lot of publicity about a certain garden, which we never know from year to year how that'll work out
sure.
either. We may have an influx at one home, and but really it always just flows so easily from 9 to 3, and with the lunch in the middle, if those patrons choose to buy the luncheon ticket, Everybody says, well, how do you control how many people are at one garden
at one
time?
How do you do that?
Time?
Do you encourage people to start at different
places?
No,
they find out where the homes are when they buy their ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on where they live or their friends live or what they're doing that day, they just pick where they want to start and end up where they want to. And we have no way of controlling that. So it's always very interesting. This will be the 18th year. We've been very fortunate. The yards always look a little, you know, walked on.
Sure.
The next day. But really, we've been quite fortunate. And I'm sure we will be this year with the weather. It'll be a beautiful day.
It'll be a beautiful day since we're putting it out there. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds like the tour itself is a lot like gardening. There's a lot you do have control over. And then there's some things you just don't.
That's a really good analogy, yes.
Hey, so you have a website. What sort of things can people see on the website?
Well, you can see some pictures from previous garden walks. You can find out how to buy a ticket. It's really simple. And you can learn a little bit about the five homes that are going to be featured.
But not the secret.
The secret.
No teasers.
Not only do you not get to find out the secret about garden in time, but you also won't get a map until you buy a ticket.
Sure, so, that makes perfect sense.
We keep our owners' privacy utmost before the walk, and you'll find out everything you need to know about the luncheon.
Sure.
And if you want to participate in that, little teasers about all the different places.
Do you have a list there of some of the beneficiaries, you know, where the money has gone to help the gardens?
Of course, we do that as well, and we've been fortunate to give money to a number of Indianapolis institutions, including the Ball Nurses Sunken Garden at Riley Hospital, the Glick Cultural Trail. Right now, our funds from the most recent donation that we've made, I should say, is to the Eskenazi Health Center. The Indianapolis Garden Club is purchasing one of the Sky Farms raised beds that are going to be on the roof of the Eskenazi Health Center.
Cool. I love that project.
Which
so
is
creative.
Such a neat thing.
Yeah.
And they're going to be growing their own food on their roof. And one of those big raised beds, I think they're 40 feet long, will be from the Indianapolis Garden Club.
Sharon Gamble with Garden Walk co-chairs Megan Roadhamel and Polly Jamison. The Indianapolis Garden Club's 18th annual Garden Walk fundraising event is Wednesday, June 5th. You can purchase tickets for the tour alone or the tour plus luncheon, but you need to get your tickets by May 28th. You can get these tickets at Kogan Antiques and Lighting in Zionsville, at Charles Mayer and Company in Indianapolis, or just visit the club's website at igcgardenwalk.com. Again, that's igcgardenwalk.com.
Hey, Travis, have you checked the gears on your bicycle?
Yes, I have. In fact, just a little tune-up, getting ready for spring, summer, whatever.
For summer, and also getting ready to ride to the Cultural Trail Grand Opening this weekend.
That's
Get down on it.
Woo-hoo. I cannot wait.
Don't worry, we're not going to sing to you.
I will have my bike out for that. So, and of course, with my helmet, too.
With your helmet, because you're a safe rider, and you're going down there not just to celebrate the opening of the trail, but because we're broadcasting live this Saturday.
I know, I can't wait. From noon to one. In front of Indy Reads Books. How fun is that going to be?
As soon as we explain to them what we're leading into here, I want to ask a question about some small mammals.
Yes.
So it's time for
What Do We Do?
And there are more than 70 events on the Cultural Trail, opening called Get Down on It this weekend, it being the trail, of course, from all four corners of the city. Well, 3.5 corners of the city. Mm-hmm. Indy Reads has an event. Explain your event.
Well, so Jenny Dwenger, our manager, came up with this idea because she realized the date was also the anniversary of the Pony Express. And so she wanted to do something because sometimes it feels like the bookstore is a little bit like in the Wild West because it's
a bit farther on the
outskirts of the trail. It's actually the far northeast side of the trail, but, you know, whatever. Direction schmections. So it's a Wild West theme on the east end, and there's going to be sort of like a Wild West tavern set up, and you can get lemonade and a train full of free books and miniature ponies. How fun is that?
That is
seriously
so cool.
There will be little ponies there in front of Indie Reads Books while we're doing our live broadcast.
Love little ponies. I might try to interview one. So you better tune in for that. Or better yet, stop by.
Come on by
we'll
and
be
say
doing
hi
some
to us.
People on the Trail interviews. That's an adaptation of Man on the Street. See how that works. Hey, other things going on. This weekend, local pianist Randy Freeling will play Rhapsody in Blue, the great Gershwin piece, with the Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Pike Performing Arts Center. So that's kind of a fun thing and lighthearted event. 3 o'clock this Sunday at the Pike Performing Arts Center. By the way, this Sunday is Mother's Day. If
that's
your mother
right.
likes Gershwin, there is an idea for something to do with your mom.
Oh, that's a very clever idea.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Hey, there's a lot of great dance going on in May, including, of course, Dance Kaleidoscope is wrapping up their season with Barefoot Renegades. This is really fun. May 16th through the 19th, two pieces choreographed by David Hochoy, as well as one piece choreographed by guest choreographer Brock Clausen, who's a award-winning choreographer who's been a part of the Joffrey Ballet, Milwaukee Ballet, and such. And he's going to be here with one of his very athletic pieces. And David is including his Afternoon of a Faun as well as a new piece, Les Noches, and that is a world premiere of his piece.
Excellent.
So that should be very cool. And that is, again, the 16th through the 19th. Dance Kaleidoscope.
If your mom is not so much into Gershwin, but she's more of a, like, alt-indie rock sort of person.
Yes.
And I know that has to describe at least one mom in our listenership, probably more. You might want to take your mom this Sunday to the Melody Inn, where a newly formed band called The Action, which is local, is performing along with Martin Bisi, Ulan Bator, and The Concrete Rivals. So a lot of really interesting, alternative, hard-driving, fascinating, and complex rock and roll going on this Sunday at the Melody Inn.
And some more dance to put on your calendar. The Indianapolis School of Ballet is presenting A Midsummer Night's Dream. And that is taking place on Friday, May 17th and Sunday the 19th. Coming up at, they'll be performing at Scottish Rite Cathedral. Now, these will be, it's a great dance performance. But if you're thinking, wait a second, Midsummer Night's Dream, who else is doing that right now? Well, it's the IRT and they're doing the play.
I knew I'd heard it somewhere.
There you go. And in fact, that is running through just this weekend. And so if you've missed your, if you've missed it so far, well, you still have a chance to check out the IRT's production of Midsummer Night's Dream through May 12th, or you can see the ballet on the 17th and 19th.
So maybe your mom is more of a hippy-dippy, folky kind of person.
Could be.
Pam, have I hit one description of you yet? Travis's
no
mom.
No dippy in there.
No dippy. Bill Staines is the performer this Saturday night, the being brought in by Indie Folk Series. If the name sounds familiar, it might be because his songs have been recorded by artists from Peter, Paul, and Mary to Jerry Jeff Walker. Nancy Griffith, no mean small artist herself, has said he carries on where Woody left off. And if you're a folk music fan, you know which Woody we're talking about. So Bill Staines this Saturday night at UUI Indie Folk Series, and it's a great evening. It's an all ages concert, 7 to 9, and go check that out with or without your mom.
And with the nicer weather, of course, comes backyard games like croquet. And it's not too soon to start getting your mallet out and ready for the Wicked World of Croquet, which is taking place this year a little early, June 1st, at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site on Delaware Street. And this year there is bracket competitive play, and there's also a leisure golf croquet bracket. And you can play in either one of those.
In.
Oh, I'll be in the competitive one, Sharon.
I know that.
And there's lunch and music and drinks and a post-tournament mixer and all types of fun stuff. If you've never been, it is a hoot. You can wear all whites all day. The 19th annual Wicked World of Croquet at the President Benjamin Harrison Home, Saturday, June 1st. Go online now, the Harrison Home's website, to register your team of two.
So maybe your mom is a fan of classic film. You getting this kind of
it's
theme
mom
here?
Theme
if
here,
they
yes.
don't remember it's Mother's Day, it's not my
yes,
fault.
No,
but you're going to have to put a little special gift certificate in her card, because this is an event going on next weekend, Saturday the 18th at 8 o'clock, House of Mystery, a 1934 film starring Ed Lowery and Verna Hilly. This is going on at the Garfield Park Arts Center. In fact, it's the final date for the 2013 Vintage Movie Nights. Eric Grayson's going going to introduce the film. Tickets are, don't tell mom, but tickets are cheap, just $4 at the door.
Nice.
Concessions are available. And in this film, well, it's a mystery with just the right amount of comedy thrown in. An old dark mansion holds an ancient secret and a killer ape. Find out more at gpacarts.org, gpacarts.org.
Well, that's all the time we have, Sharon. So well, we will be back next week
with things to do with your mom and others on
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Last Friday night, in an unoccupied retail space that is part of the Mozo development in Fountain Square, a number of people took turns placing their ears to a small speaker located in the center of the top of a desk. What they heard was an almost dreamlike collection of voices, each describing what Indianapolis means to them. The event was the culmination of the Bureau of Manufactured History, which has been a project of the We Are City group. Travis DiNicola invited We Are City's John Beeler and Bureau member James Reeves in to learn more. This interview was recorded last month.
John, James, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys here.
Hey, Travis.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, John. Tell me a little bit of We Are City is a very cool email that goes out, but there's also a lot more behind it than that, than getting updates on what's happening in town twice a week. Give me a little bit more background on that before we talk specifically about what James is doing in town and his involvement.
Yep. We started We Are City a couple of years ago as a conference, called it Unbranded, and mm-hmm. it was a partnership with the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Focusing on what we now call city building. So okay. this would be basically making communities and neighborhoods better, more livable, more enjoyable. And it expanded into a couple things, actually three things. One would be the briefing, which you talked about, which is the email mm-hmm. that goes out Tuesday and Thursdays. And then the second thing is the summit, which is a conference that we do once a year. And we bring in speakers from both here in Indianapolis and all over the country. And then the third thing is this We Are City import, which is James, is why James is here.
And he's an import.
He's an import. this is, I think, artist residency, but for yeah. what we would call city builders. These are people that we think are doing a great job improving the city that they live in. So we wanted to bring a couple of those people here and see what happens.
So how many imports have you had, or is this the first? Or?
James is our second resident. We
second,
had
okay.
another one. His name was Zoe. He was here in November. He did an incredible art project where he took pictures of paramecium and amoebas mm-hmm. in our waterways and then cast those up in video form at Clues Hall. And
okay.
it was really great. So.
And then you have another artist coming up very soon.
Yep. That would be Oliver Blank.
Okay.
He's also with the same organization that James is a part of called Civic Center.
Okay.
And Ollie does a little bit more music-based, web design-based, kind of programming and code. And he was here I don't know if you were there, Travis, but he was at the summit last year.
Okay. Spoke. No, I did miss that. I'm sorry that I did. Yeah. You know, as I said, I mean, I knew that there were other things going on with We Are City, but, you know, I think I'm one of those people who's kind of guilty of thinking of it as just the email. And the emails are great. I mean, mm-hmm. they're, you know, as you said, twice a week. What I love about it, there's, you know, there's no images. It's just text, which actually I kind of adore. They're quick. They're easy. You hit a lot of good information. It takes like a minute to read. If you want to, you know, link on more, you can. But it's always interesting updates as far as what's going on in the city with, you know, interesting people doing stuff in arts and culture and food and neighborhoods and what have you. But sort of like a quick and easy things that, you know, oftentimes things that maybe get missed by the rest of the media, too.
Yep. Yep. And, well, thanks for reading, Travis. It's good to know that you do read it. And
yeah.
That's why we do it, is to be read. And also to just kind of bring awareness to people doing interesting, good things in the city and in other cities, too.
Yeah. So, James, let's talk about your involvement here. How did you find out about this project to begin with? I mean, the idea of saying, I want to export myself to some other city.
I was invited by We Are City through Oliver. Actually, I've been trying to figure that out.
How'd you get here?
It's a little murky, right?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about tell me about your background. Where are you coming from on this?
Right now I live in New Orleans, mm-hmm. and I run a design studio with my partner Oliver Blank, as well as my partner Candy Chang. Mm-hmm. And been in New Orleans for about 3 years.
Okay.
And before that, I taught design in New York at Parsons, and actually went to New Orleans with some idea of going to law school, but then focused a lot more on city issues in New Orleans, and it's just a great place to be right now as far as that goes.
No, I can only imagine. Well, I mean, tell me about your design studio. I mean, what type of work do you do, and how does that connect with city building in New Orleans?
Well, we're called Civic Center, mm-hmm. and we focus specifically on cities. Mm-hmm. We're not so focused on a particular type of discipline or service.
Okay.
We do graphic design, copywriting, identity, interactive design, as well as music and fiction, anything that has to do with cities.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the work that we do involves education and community building and things like that. The idea of the project that we're doing here is mm-hmm. really kind of a counterpoint to... Still trying to figure out how to talk about this well, but I think there's a bit of a gold rush on cities right now, where there's this sort of a sustainable, spontaneous intervention, tactical urbanism 3.0 TED style of talking about cities, where there's this kind of homogenous, and don't get me wrong, I think it's great that people are returning to cities and there's this energy towards talking about cities, and like mm-hmm. our company is certainly a part of that. But I think amidst all the conversations about bike lanes and pop-up food trucks and things like that, it reduces cities to very clinical spaces, and there isn't much of a room for sort of the fiction of cities or the personality of cities. For example, like what makes Indianapolis tick and what makes it different from Cleveland or Detroit or Philadelphia. So the project that we're doing here...
Right, because, I mean, so many of the conversations you hear about city development, it's like, well, this worked great in Portland, or, you know, well, we don't want to do this like Cleveland, we want to, you know, or either defining yourself, you know, as trying to become like some other city or not like another city often is what comes up, but especially, I think, with mid-sized cities like Indianapolis. But there I go, I just defined it again. Falling into that trap. Okay, so how do we get out of that?
Well, I'm not sure. Like, what we're doing with the Bureau of Manufactured History, the project here, is really focusing on kind of the urban legends and rumors and gossip mm-hmm. and sort of just dive and rebop on the street corner that you might hear about a city. So we're really looking at, you know, empty buildings in Indianapolis and the stories that might surround them,
mm-hmm.
stuff that's in the past that, you know, is maybe taken on the stuff of legend.
Yeah.
You know, when a lot of times when people don't know what's going on in a city, they kind of default to the spectral they, you know,
sure.
Well, they won't redevelop the building because of this, or they want to do things this way. And I think that actually starts to foster kind of an antagonistic relationship between the city and its government.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that fiction...
Because they is assumed to be sort of the leadership, whether it be the government or other community leaders.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times their intentions just aren't legible to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what's actually happening with this property, what's its status, you know, who stands to profit, why hasn't this been developed or why hasn't this been improved? You know, why are people being displaced in a certain neighborhood or is another neighborhood not getting the attention it needs?
Sure.
That said, I do think there's something with urban legends and sort of fictions about a city that really reflect a city's concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're starting to kind of collect those and get help.
Okay, so I got to know, what have you been hearing? I mean, you've been hearing a little bit in Indianapolis?
Yeah, we have. And what's interesting to me is doing this project in Indianapolis.
I mean, this is going to air after you've left town, so you can tell us everything right now on the radio.
I will say it's been an interesting project because to me, and I don't know if this is right, but... I think Indianapolis is one of the more neutral cities in terms of a national reputation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major city that everyone's heard of, but unlike most other cities, you can't immediately find your footing and say, oh, they used to make cars, or they have a big crime problem, or they're going through this big hipster gentrification phase, or what. You know, it's very neutral in a way, and I think people have a hard time identifying what's exactly in the city, which is good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been an interesting challenge to kind of start this project of, you know, looking at personalities of cities and starting in Indianapolis, you know, where there wasn't this immediate overlay of history that everybody nationally is aware of.
Right.
So being here, it's been amazing hearing the stories about Indiana's perception of itself as maybe kind of part of the South,
mm-hmm.
as, you know, part of the Midwest, as part of the Appalachian region, and sort of the stories that kind of emerge from that. The ways that it distinguishes itself in terms of, like, its politics, having had a lot more of a conservative history,
mm-hmm.
which starts to kind of spin off into stories about the John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan and during that era and these sort of shadow histories that maybe a lot of people don't talk about as much, or maybe they do, you know, but mm-hmm. that are always present that we carry with us.
So who are you talking to get the stories, or how are you finding people?
Well, we're working on that right now. So right now, you know, I'm just kind of writing whatever pops into my head on this website, you know, and we set up a phone line where people can call and we give them these sort of prompts. Basically, we're trying to take the tactics of surrealism and Dada, you know, that they used to look at, like automatic writing and automatic responses, and try to apply that to the personality of a city.
Okay. So we have, I was thinking of Exquisite Corpse, but okay.
So sure. We have these, you know, cards where it says, like, you know, run to the nearest intersection and dial this phone number. Mm-hmm. And then you call the phone number, you'll get like a random question of what's the most frightening thing about Indianapolis, or describe the soul of Indianapolis in 5 words. And we've been getting some really interesting responses that way. And we're trying to break outside kind of just the internet, because that becomes a bit of an echo chamber.
Sure.
So we're going to be focusing on having more flyers and posters, trying to get them into, like, you know, bulletin boards and things like that to reach as many people as possible. And we're just starting to get that underway.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll definitely be looking for more of those. What is the website that people, though, are going to for this?
It's BureauOfManufacturedHistory.com.
Okay. But again, you'll also be reaching out through flyers and phones and different things. Interesting stuff. So can you share with me? I'm dying here for something specific, like something you've heard from someone who's already responded about, something that, you know, terrifies them about Indianapolis, or that they think defines it, or that stood out for you so far. This is totally unscientific, absolutely anecdotal, but give me something specific.
Okay. I guess two things that I just recently heard. One was, and I don't know when this happened, but somebody was telling me about how recently a couple exploded their house to collect the insurance money.
Right,
and when it exploded, it ended up killing some of the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess
very recent news.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess there was a lot of chatter, both on local radio stations as well as online, that this was a botched Defense Department missile that landed, you know. And so again, like, why?
Yeah, people were talking about, like, that it was a drone that that people were there was a, you know, a practice with a drone operation that had gone wrong or something at first. At one point, I remember hearing some people say that in the news.
Which
I guess from the outside, that sounds like, why would people even think that?
Right. Exactly.
Of course, I also heard aliens too, but you know, so you know, it's all in the X-Files.
And then two sites that I'm really fascinated by that I just learned about a couple days ago is the old Riverside Amusement Park, and then its kind of competitor for 5 years, Wonderland, and the history of segregation that occurred there, where Riverside Amusement Park would have what was called Colored Frolic Day, and it was the one day a year that people who weren't white were able to come in if they brought in these milk bottle caps. And apparently, I guess the IUPUI, I think, the university is built on this old vibrant African-American neighborhood. And
right.
They're talking about how they'll excavate, like, these milk bottle caps, you know, that were brought to Riverside. And at the same time, its competitor for 1906 to 1911, Wonderland Amusement Park, which had, like, one of its most popular exhibits was chain-smoking bears.
Wow, I've not heard about that, but okay.
Filipino family that they would put on stage.
Wow.
And it was just this and it had these speakeasies called, I think, the Blind Tiger. Anyway, they announced that they were going
to... I mean, I know a little bit of that history, only because from local historian Connie Ziegler has written some about those parks, but this is really fascinating. Okay, sorry, keep going.
And the day that in the newspaper they announced that they were going to be integrated and allow African-Americans to come to the park. The first day was a success, and then 2 hours later, the park was burned to the ground in 1911. And there's all these stories about it was just a cigarette butt, or maybe it was intentional. You know, just the idea of these two...
A cigarette butt from one of the bears?
Yeah, the chain-smoking bears.
Right, well, you know, you can never trust a chain-smoking bear, but wow, interesting stuff.
What I appreciate about what James is doing, too, is that he's not approaching... I actually have a historic training background, and he's not approaching it like a historian would, trying to determine facts and applying methods of deduction.
You're not going to let the facts get in your way at all, are you? No.
It's very much about the ether, and I think there's a value to that, and so that's what I appreciate about his project. So if he gets his facts wrong, it's okay.
It's okay. But this is more than just urban legend, though, too. It's really looking at sort of how these myths and stories and histories however you define them, how people understand them and how they define where they live. I mean, that's kind of what you're doing. Is that close to this?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, okay. Cool, interesting. Now, and you have not done this with other cities yet, have you?
We haven't, no. So like I said, it's just something that kind of came out of the idea of, like, you know, there needs to be more fiction and storytelling that's a little bit more playful, that plays with history.
Interesting.
And how do you define the personality of a city?
Yeah. So then once you go back to New Orleans, and then your partner, your design partner, Oliver, will be coming up here, and then we'll be taking over sort of where you leave off?
Yeah, he's basically going to pick up the pieces and make it coherent. I'm sorry, taking a lot of the voicemail and audio and putting it into public space so people can listen to it.
Okay, so that was my next question, actually, is, you know, how does this all get sort of resolved? I mean, how will people access this or see this or read this or hear this? So.
Yeah, we're putting it together. At the end, we're hoping to have like a proper broadcast of all the audio that we've collected that Ollie's going to arrange and compose and put into public space. And then we'd really like to prepare like kind of a final book, you know, that might be sold locally or wherever that, you know, collects the sort of narratives we've been encountering here.
Excellent. Very cool. Very, very cool stuff. John, let me ask you, what's next for We Are City besides importing interesting artists?
Well, we're working on the summit, which will be August 22nd or 23rd. It's a Thursday.
Okay.
That'll be at the Indiana History Center. We've got some big plans for that. We're really excited, and we've got some really terrific speakers coming in. So that's the next target. And then we're working with a few partners to improve the briefing. We won't be adding photos, so you can rest assured.
Okay, good, good.
But maybe you just kind of tweaking it a little bit and streamlining the process of developing it. So those are the two big things on the docket.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who's really thrown when the New Yorker added photographs. So
yeah,
I'm still not quite ready for you guys. Okay, well, cool. Well, great. Well, thank you both for coming in Art of the Matter Day. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Travis. Thanks for having us.
Travis DiNicola with We Are City's John Beeler and Bureau of Manufactured History member James Reeves. To learn more about We Are City, visit their website at wearecity.us, and that is spelled wearcity.us. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I get a preview of a new exhibit at the Rhythm Discovery Center.
Speaking of offbeat, I'll take a look at a new production of Spamalot.
Fun. And then I'll find out what's going on at this year's Broad Ripple Art Fair. Plus, there'll be our calendar of events we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.